told members of my family we were coming up to Edinburgh and I would be coming to Crieff on the Monday. Oh yes, what's that for? Well, it's a gathering of ministers. Well, what for? Well, you know, we tackle a subject. What's your subject, Dad? Wisdom. At which they'd fall around laughing and wonder what the church is coming to. Thank you very much for the chance to share this. When T.S. Eliot agonized over the decline of the God-centered vision of the world in the face of aggressive secularism in our culture, he coined his well-known questions. Here they are. Where is the life we have lost in living? Where is the wisdom we have lost in knowledge? Where is the knowledge we have lost in information? Now, somewhere in there, there's a whole sermon series for the next 12 months. Here are questions with which to confront our IT, our overconfident IT culture. Our internet society swims in oceans of information and numbers and images, but where is the wisdom? This is not a word used in those circles. How many Microsoft programmers does it take to change a bulb? None. Bill Gates will just redefine light. Which is a measure of their supreme self-confidence, but it begs the question, yes, but Bill, where is the wisdom? Hence the Gandalf phenomenon. The yearning, the longing for a good, powerful shaman to appear among us who can deal out of the center of things, not just mere cleverness, not just mere expertise, but who can visit the center of things where the outcomes are decided and bring us some wisdom out of it and tell us how to live. I don't think you're very much concerned with here, with the procedures preceding the appointment of the next Archbishop of Canterbury, but there's been a number of interesting articles in the Times especially, where the good lady who writes these things, Mary Ann Sigurd, coined an amazing phrase the other day, and she said, we need, of the three front runners, we need this particular man. We need Richard Chartres from London, because he can cope with the, I quote, the Merlin deficit. Here is a wise man who will appear amongst us and teach us how to live. Now, brothers and sisters, we are the children of the one who is the wisdom of God, in whom lie hidden all the treasures of wisdom of knowledge and knowledge. And he famously said to his critics on that occasion when they criticized him for having too much of a good time in life, he said that wisdom, to use the old version, wisdom is justified by her children. Or as the more mundane modern translations would say, she is proved right by her actions. I prefer the former. She is justified by her children. There's no argument for wisdom. It's very interesting, this. You can't with pencil and paper and diagram say, ah, this is wisdom. This is what you must follow. It doesn't work that way. Wisdom will be justified in our culture, in our society, by her children, people who actually live wisely. Our lives will supply evidence that Jesus is the wisdom of God. There is no other evidence. Personally, and not just because of this talk, but personally, I realized thinking about this, that I have for several years now used the term truth less and less, and wisdom more and more. Truth can be a red rag to a bull with people. Amongst ourselves, we talk of the truth, of course. But these days, when you're in certain arguments, debates, and conversations, you say the truth. You can see them flying to their various corners and defending their positions, and the whole game is up before you've begun. But I find that if you talk about, is this a wise course of action? Marriage is breaking up, all kinds of pastoral things, all kinds of things. Even with young people, those tearaway young people who are absolutely hell-bent on doing something, I find more and more like an ancient granddad, a Gandalf figure saying, hold on, is this a wise course of action? And how do you measure wise? Well, what will be the outcome? Will it lead to health or to destruction? Well, are we perceived as wise? Is the Church of Jesus Christ in our place at our time perceived by our world as wise? That is, are we perceived as people who have mastered the art of living? People who somehow crack the secret and they know how to move and to move to take decisions and choices and actions which move you into life and health and indeed prosperity. And the answer sadly has to be no. We are too insecure in our own doctrine. We are too ambiguous about our reason for being here. And wisdom sounds an impossibly, embarrassingly large word for the church to bear. I think that's not an exaggeration. Oh, you know the little quip. The science graduate asks, why does this work? The engineering graduate asks, how does it work? The accountancy graduate asks, how much will it cost? And the theology graduate asks, would you like tips with that? Wisdom seems to be, I say seems to be, there's no definition, it's just the outcomes, it's all measured by outcomes. It is this ability, this energy, this decision, this ability to bring ideas to fruition for purposes to move to success, for intention to be brought to fulfillment. And that seems to work at every level in Scripture. It is true of the craftsman, of the sailor, it is used of the soldier and of the king. It holds true for whether you're building a fire, a marriage, a congregation, a nation, or the cosmos. There is a way of seeing and deciding and acting which leads to life. Therefore, our Lord Jesus Christ, as the wisdom of God, moves between the Father's intention and the fulfillment of the salvation of the world. Conversely, and this is a nice example of wisdom, or stood on its head, in Hosea 13:13, you get this intriguing little image about the unwise embryo. Hosea says the unwise embryo knows neither the timing, come on, time's up, you've got to come out, and it can't find the direction out of the womb. And that, to put it mildly, is a rather unwise situation. It doesn't know it's time to go, it doesn't know its kairos has come, and it doesn't know the way out anyway, and this is unwisdom. It is an amazing picture of our culture, which knows neither the timing of things, or the way out, or the way ahead. So timing involves, wisdom involves this idea of timing and direction, therefore the famous celebration of kairos of timing in Ecclesiastes 3, you remember. Now this, I found this such a vast subject, brothers and sisters, and I don't want to go over ground which is very familiar with you and will just waste your time. So I suggest that we concentrate our thinking on the wisdom teaching in Job and Proverbs. But having said that, in particular, the teaching, the strange teaching there concerning wisdom as immanent in the world. The way God has conferred wisdom upon creation, so that creation is a wise creation. And this is not abstract or remote by any means from the practicalities of our ministry. You'll find that this is fundamental to the way that we look at the world and to the way that we see what is going on in our parishes and our neighborhoods and the way people act. Gerard Manley Hopkins, who we'll quote once or twice here this morning, said this: all things, therefore, are charged with love, are charged with God. And if we know how to touch them, give off sparks and take fire, yield drops and flow, ring and tell of him. What an incredible creation this is, if you know how to touch it, and wisdom knows how to touch it. And wise people are those who know how to touch the created order, and according to Hopkins, because it's charged with God, it will give off sparks and take fire, it will yield drops and flow, it will ring and tell of him. Now, I find it a very uncanny thought that the one who is the wisdom of God himself came to self-awareness by meditating upon these scriptures, upon Psalms and Proverbs and Job and Ecclesiastes. His own mental formation came as he grounded himself. He who is the wisdom of God and the wisdom teacher was formed as he grounded himself in these selfsame scriptures which you and I have before us. It is by meditating in these scriptures he filled his mind with them. These are the soil in which his thought grew. They supplied the alphabet in which he spelled and the idiom by which he expressed his own wisdom and ideas. Here is the doctrine which he took up and transformed. And clearly, when you see how they taught, not merely that what they said was wise, but how they expressed their wisdom, you find exactly the same in Jesus, raised to a much higher power. He is the wisdom teacher. It's worth pondering that, by the way. I used to think that maybe this way of expressing wisdom in Proverbs, for example, is just a stylistic thing. These are rather arty, elitist, highly educated people who went in for this highly polished kind of stuff. Well, von Raab will tell you and show you that, oh no, it is absolutely integral to the actual nature of wisdom itself, the way in which you express it. So we have two things going on here all the time. There is both the investigation of life, looking very penetratively at life and asking what kind of action leads to this result, or if you do that, then this happens. And having observed this, then asking, how can we now express this? And giving this incredible attention to a form of poetry, to a form of rhyme, to a form of balance, all to make it, in a very merciful way, to make it memorable to the audience. Only if you prepare your sermons like that. You see, what I think, we say it within these four walls, what I think, is that what we need to do is to recover the wisdom model of Christian living to correct the Corinthian charismatic model, which sweeps the board, of course. It is the controlling model of Christian living today, the powerful one, the one which sweeps all before it, is the Corinthian charismatic model. I live within it, by the mercy of God. But it's massively limited by itself. And indeed stops you thinking and stops you. Who needs to look intently at life when the Spirit will give you the answer? Who needs all this stuff, weighing things up, and wondering why this happens when this lady makes that decision? Who needs that when the Spirit will lead you? So what do you do with Proverbs, for goodness sake, and Job? No, we need to recover this and bring this into the Spirit-filled life, this way of looking at life, of honouring life with our attention, that there is something absolutely worthwhile going on in there, and we will look at it and we will arrive at conclusions about the way in which we ought to act and the way in which we ought to live. Okay, let's plunge into Job 28. And whether this is a cold bath or a sauna, I'm not quite sure how you'll find that. And we can really just sketch out the what we're after here. Because Job 28 is fundamental to everything which we'll say this morning, and fundamental to everything in wisdom literature. Job 28 is, in fact, this incredible poem. It's a celebration of man's technical ingenuity and courage and sheer perseverance in mining for precious materials. There are mines for silver and places where gold is refined. Iron is won from the earth. Notice the emphasis is on the earth. It's in the mountains. It's in the hills. Why do they think that? Because what they were going to say, as you know, is, well, we found the gold, we found the iron, we found the silver, we found the precious stones. We can't find wisdom in here. Why are they looking in the mountain for wisdom? Wouldn't you think you would look to the sky for wisdom? But these wise people burrow into the earth, on the not unreasonable assumption that priceless wisdom will be found somewhere alongside precious materials. Not such a bad idea, actually. So off they go in their search. Verse 2, men master the darkness. To the farthest recesses they seek ore in gloom and deep darkness. Incredible commitment and perseverance. Foreigners cut the shafts. Forgotten, suspended without foothold, they swing to and fro, far away from anyone. While grain is springing from the earth above, what lies beneath is turned over like a fire, and out of its rocks come lapis lazuli, dusted with flecks of gold. No bird of prey knows the path there. The falcon's keen eye cannot descry it. Proud beasts do not set foot on it, and no lion passes there. Man sets his hand to the granite rock and lays bare the roots of the mountains. He cuts galleries in the rocks, and gems of every kind meet his eye. He dams up the sources of the streams and brings out the hidden riches of earth to light. But where can wisdom be found? And where is the source of understanding? And again in verse 23, you get the same refrain. Or rather, in verse 20. Where then does wisdom come from? Where is the source of understanding? No creature on earth can set eyes on it. So here is a dilemma. Here is a real dilemma. There is this feeling. And these things are known through the body and the skin as much as through the intellect. There is this kind of deep instinct among us that wisdom is here somewhere. Don't ask me where. I can't give you the coordinates for it, and I can't give you a definition, but I just know, because we touch it and we bump into it and we see it and we feel it, that wisdom is here. And life is not possible without it, but I can't find my way to it. So that explains the dilemma. I can't find that without which I cannot live. And then, of course, comes the famous conclusion in verse 28. And God said to mankind, "The fear of the Lord is wisdom, and to turn from evil, that is understanding." And that, of course, is the slogan and the motto of wisdom teaching. It is found in the fear of the Lord. Notice, not that you've got wisdom and you bolt onto it a certain kind of reverence for God, as if that raises its level. No, the fear of the Lord means that you make a commitment, you make a decision, you orientate your life around and you say, this is wisdom, in this direction I commit myself to the Lord, this is my stance, my orientation. And it is this stance which opens the doors of perception, and there is no other way into it. So we feel its presence, but it eludes our grasp. God alone knows the way to it, verse 23, and so we go to him. And of course, you can't have the wisdom without the wise one. That's what it means. Just as Jesus, exactly the same in Jesus, when he gives you, for example, in Matthew 13, and he gives you that whole catenary of parables, when they say, why do you teach in this wisdom kind of way? And he gives them that great catenary of metaphors and parables, all about the kingdom of God is like, but he never tells you what the kingdom is. It's like this, it's like this, it's like this. Yes, but what is it, Lord? No, I'm not telling you that. Because you can't have the definition without the king. Otherwise, you'll make off with it. I've got this definition. I know what the kingdom is. Oh, no. You don't have definitions apart from a relationship with the king. That's what it's saying here. You can't have wisdom without the wise one. And so it's on our knees, the humbling of our minds, the orientating of our lives towards him in reverence, and we are promised the gift of wisdom. Now then, it is this amazing idea which we feel instinctively, and these scriptures spell out, that not only has the wise God created wisely, we know that, but that he has, how can we express this? He has impressed wisdom in its textures. Look at Proverbs 3:19. Proverbs 3:19, and there's so many of these verses. Let's take Proverbs 3:19 is a good statement of this. And my version is the Revised English Bible. Proverbs 3:19. By wisdom, or in wisdom, by wisdom, the Lord laid the earth's foundations, and by understanding, he set the heavens in place. So the earth's foundations and the heavens are the wisdom and the understanding of the Lord put into stuff, put into shape and form and rhyme and reason, and the laws of creation and the laws of human behavior. Psalm 104, verse 24 will be another one. Psalm 104, verse 24. Countless are the things you have made, Lord. By your wisdom, you have made them all. So we ask again, what is this elusive thing, this way into life? As we think about it as impressed in creation, and my word, you see, we've lost the battle here. We've handed all this over to the New Age people. We've handed this over, and many of the things that are mentioned here will strike you maybe as scarily green and bordering on the New Age. That's because we've lost the battle. That's why we feel that. This is our subject, not theirs. And these sub-Christian cults have stepped in where we have withdrawn from creation. And people find they're doing them a favor by calling for a kind of a reverence and a respect for the created order. Wisdom in the created order seems to be its meaning, its order, its purpose. It's in the rhyme and the reason of things. It's in the organizing voice behind the world, speaking out of the divine mystery of creation. I hope you don't think this is high-flying stuff. I'm sure that you know this instinctively. In non-human creation, as well as in the sphere of human society, wisdom doesn't merely exist in the world like a color or a temperature, but it actively addresses man. It orientates towards the people of your parish and it speaks to them. Wisdom in the orderliness of their life, the way they do things, the way you organize your household, the way you hope that your family will relate, the way you hope things will go at work, the way you arrange things neatly, and the whole rhyme and reason, the incredible pattern and orderliness of life speaks to people. And we ought to cash in on this. This is, to use the old term, pre-evangelism, if you will. These are stepping stones out there between people who seem to have no glimmer of the gospel and the Lord himself. This is a way in. This is a way towards Christian things. So, Proverbs 1, verse 20, if you will. Having said that, wisdom turns towards the world and addresses the world. Here she is, Mother Superior, or your big sister, if you like. Proverbs 1, verse 20, to begin with. And notice just how definite this is. It's not some woofly, woozy, kind of candy flossy idea floating around. Nothing could be more precise and muscular and definite here, if you can have a muscular Mother Superior. Verse 20. Wisdom. Now we're moving from the generalities, from this kind of rather mysterious wisdom presence to its personification. She is a she. Wisdom cries aloud in the open air. She raises her voice in the public places. Now then you read on and notice where she operates with her loud voice. And if you've ever been in an Eastern market, you know she'd have to speak very loud indeed to be heard over the noise. Apparently she is. So it's not some little ghostly whisper in the corner within the four walls of some spiritual institution up there on the top of Mount Kathmandu or something. It's down here in the marketplace and the noise in the stock exchange and the racket and the people. Look where she stands in verses 20 and 21 as she cries aloud. It's in the open air. It's in the public places. It's at the top of the bustling streets, at the approaches to the city gates. And what does she say? Well, she is giving them a terrific wigging. She calls at the top, verse 21, she calls at the top of the bustling streets, at the approaches to the city gates, she says, "How long will you simple fools be content with your simplicity?" So this is more of a, you know, very tough-minded school of pastoral practice this. This is more of a slap in the face than a hug. Apparently, wisdom is at work addressing and rebuking people. We'll have to ask what that means in a second. Before you and I get up and set up our open air stall down in the marketplace, she's been at it. She's amongst the crowds, and she's in there amongst their worries and their thoughts and their ambitions, amongst the wheeling and the dealing in the stock exchange. She's in the banks, she's in the schools, she's in the colleges. Wherever there are people and there are crossroads, there she is, and she is calling. That's why we're here this morning. She called us once. And of course, she can be refused. Verses 24 to 28, you'll notice that she can be refused with catastrophic results. Verse 24, but because you refused to listen to my call, because no one heeded when I stretched out my hand, because you rejected all my advice and would have none of my repute, I in turn shall laugh at your doom and deride you when terror comes. Your terror comes like a hurricane, and your doom approaches like a whirlwind when anguish and distress come upon you. If you fiddle the books in the stock exchange, you're in for it. It will find you out, as we say. What finds you out? What finds you out? Well, there is a way of doing the books which is honest, which is true to wisdom. And there's a way of corruption, and it will find you out. You'll end up in jail. This is not fate or luck. This is how wisdom has structured life. Now, this is very interesting to ask what exactly this means to us in practical terms. I mean, I stand before you as one of the great non-managers of the Church of England, as my poor congregations will attest. And it grieves me to admit, it breaks my heart to have to admit, that wisdom is seen in the gift of administration. And there is no doubt about it, all other things being equal, that a well-administered congregation flourishes more than a confused congregation. Whereas I used to rationalise the spirituality, oh, I'm not into that sort of thing. The Lord can bless us. Nothing to do with that. So I would hide in the old docetism between kind of real life where wisdom works and this spiritual plane of mine, calling upon the Lord to come and bless my inefficiency and my incompetence at administration. No, therefore, in Romans 12:7, I have to admit, administration is a gift of the Spirit. Because good administration is a sign of the presence and the activity of wisdom. She blesses people by creating space in the organization and folk know where they are. It's wonderful to know where you are, isn't it? So they can breathe and move, and there's a feeling of blessing and of well-being where it's well administered. This is not just a trick of the Church Growth Incorporated. This is the gift of wisdom. But I ask you, and here I stand again very rebuked as a great scorner of administration in church things. I remember reading a publication from Church Growth in the States where they had worked out that if you park your car where you can see the entrance of the church, more people will come to church. I mean, what's that got to do with the Holy Spirit? But that's how we're made. There's something about this. And those wise people have cottoned on to this. There's something about human nature. It likes to see the line between where I leave my car and where I go into the building. My wife insists our new local Tesco doesn't do it that way. But anyway, this is church growth theory. I'm old enough to say I stand before you as someone who actually heard, I heard him say, the Reverend Dr. Martin Lloyd-Jones pour public derision upon an announcement from the Billy Graham organization during the 1956 Haringey Crusades, that not so many came to faith last night because a fuse blew. Imagine saying that to Dr. Martin Lloyd-Jones. I can see him now mocking this. Aha, so God's sovereign plans for people are thwarted by a 5-amp fuse. And we all fell around laughing. But actually, there's something in it. Otherwise, we're in cloud cuckoo land. Otherwise, it's magic. Otherwise, we are floating. But in this real world where electricity has to flow through here, if you're going to here, fuses do matter, don't they? I mean, this is an expression of the way wisdom has constructed life. It's how to handle things. The nature of things speak to us. There is a way of living and of conducting business, a way of integrity or a way of sleaze, a way of with our relationships, a way of faithfulness or a way of exploitation and oppression. And there is hell to pay if we offend and violate wisdom in the way she has set things up. Now, of course, these things are said in a wisdom kind of way. Very interesting to ponder this. I mean, it was 6 minutes into the Harry Potter film when I understood the symbolism of owls. If you want to indicate to your locality, this is a very important moment. You could put up a banner outside the church. This is a very important moment. See the reaction. They clear the street. You could hire a van and go around and shout through a megaphone. This is a very important moment, and then see the reaction. You could do a leaflet drop. This is a very important moment down at the church. And the wags will ask, well, if it's that important, why is your communication so naff? No, if it's that important, send in owls. That apparently is the way to do it in the Harry Potter film. And if you get a flock of owls descending around your house, you say, hello, there's something rather important going on here. There is something about owls, famously wise and enigmatic, and they make you feel rather shallow and frivolous. They have been to places and see things that you haven't. An owl indicates this is a very important moment. Jesus sent in his owls, I mean parables, and symbolic speech and action and metaphors. And he got it from these people. I mean, look at Ecclesiastes. Just for a little light relief, look at Ecclesiastes 10 and verse 11, and ponder this before you nod off to sleep tonight, and see how many applications you can make. What we're saying here is that this is not just wisdom, an observation of the way wisdom works in the world, but it's wisdom wisely said in a way that teases and snags and you can't get it out of your mind, and you stay with it and it draws you in and you're moving at all kinds of levels, just as Jesus taught. That's why they heard him, listened to him so well. Verse 11, if a snake bites before it is charmed, the snake charmer loses his feet. I think we would apply that to a situation where you're standing in a shop and you say to the salesman, I'll only buy it if it works. If it doesn't work, I won't buy it. I will pay you by results. If a snake bites before it's charmed, the snake charmer loses its fee. And then you realize, oh no, there's something more going on here. Or does it also mean it's warning against handling dangerous situations? Or it's saying, wait, do you know what you're getting into here? Is the snake charmed before you get into this? Good marriage counselling, actually. Or is it saying, don't do a deal with the devil? It's saying, what is to be the likely outcome of this action if the snake isn't charmed, it's just lying there? Not only wise, but wisely said. Now then, okay, wisdom is in the centres of the action. Let me give you a couple of examples plucked out of recent copies of the newspaper. I've chosen two iconic events, as they say, iconic in the life of our so-called culture. One is a fashion show in Paris, but the first one is the 49th Biennale, I think you pronounce it thus, in Venice, the great art jamboree last year. And these examples show, right in the heart of our culture, where it matters most to people, where wisdom is rejected and the God-centered vision of life is rejected, then as she warned in verse 24 of Proverbs 1, there is hell to pay. And you can't cheat it, and you can't get away from it. There is a price to be paid here if you violate her, if you violate wisdom. So this is the kind of situation that we're into. Here's a report in the Times last June. At the 49th Venice Biennale, this great modern art bash. The Italian pavilion contained several other unfamiliar artists. Erne Liis-Semper, a young newcomer from Estonia, plays a dejected crop-haired woman in a grainy black and white video installation called, with enormous imagination, FF/VY. In this video, after reading this consonantly at a table, she gets up. This is the peak of our artistic expression. After reading this consonantly at a table, she gets up, puts a noose around her neck, and kicks over the stool supporting her feet. Respite is offered the viewer as the footage goes into reverse, taking her back to the table. But she then attempts another suicide with a gun and finally succeeds in hanging herself again. End of film. Richard Cook goes on, in his high-minded way, Paul Graham's photographs likewise take us into an arena we would prefer to avoid, the graffiti-strewn walls of public lavatories, where desperate loners scrawl details of their sexual longings. Against all odds, listen to this, Graham's dark-toned images often take on the eloquence of paintings. If you reject wisdom, you end up with this. Profoundly impressed with graffiti on the walls of public loos. Take this little one I just saw the other day, just because this stuff is, papers are crammed full of this stuff, you see. These examples of a culture which has rejected wisdom and is now paying the price. Here's just a snippet about the great Paris art fashion show there. It looks, says this man, these are not Christians writing, it looked like a misogynistic fantasy of warped sexual dawning and about as corrupt and twisted as anything I've ever seen, albeit entirely in keeping with a world dominated by the despotic chimera of eternal youth, power, sexuality, and the tyranny of beauty. He goes on to talk about the odious gratuitousness of this great, flashy, most important show in Paris this year kind of thing. Now, we don't bat an eyelid at this stuff. Because we're so conditioned by it, because it's in the air. And what we need to point out and rub society's noses in is that if you offend and you reject the wisdom of the God-centered life, this is what happens. And there is no escape. So these are some of the consequences of violating her. Here's another one. Take the great mantra of personal liberty, personal freedom of choice. This is the great thing. Do what you will, but you must not in any way threaten someone's personal freedom of choice. And in the name of that mantra, in the name of that great slogan, wisdom is violated. But she gets her own back. I'm just reading some stuff from the States, where the author pointed out that last year, 30% of all pregnancies were aborted. So there was a massive rejection of the infant. And then 30% of those who actually made it out of the womb were greeted by one parent only. The father, presumably in the name of his own freedom, personal freedom of choice, as high-heeled it off to somewhere else, he's left. And then 30% of those who then make it to the age of 10 will lose one parent by divorce, where one of them decides to leave. So there is this incredible culture of massive rejection of children going on in the heart of our culture. There will be hell to pay for this. And indeed there is, isn't there? This is not God punishing. This is wisdom who has been rejected. And if you do this, you don't get away with it. And I think perhaps rather than kind of talking about the truth of these things, we ought to just show people that where wisdom is violated, then there's a price to pay. And is not our society hell-bent on a very unwise course of action? Turn over to Proverbs 8, 1 to 3. Where we start off with more of the same, and Mother Superior is still at it. Proverbs 8, 1 to 3, and again she's at the crossroads and by the wayside. Hear how wisdom calls, verse 1 of Proverbs 8, and understanding lifts her voice. She takes her stand at the crossroads, by the wayside, at the top of the hill, beside the gate, at the entrance to the city. At the approach by the portal, she cries aloud, "It is to you I call, to all mankind I appeal." And she will not be shut up. So she is not, wisdom is not an individual possession which wise people have somehow concocted within themselves. And she is not confined within the walls of spiritual institutions. She inhabits the secular world. She is God's voice in the secular world. She is establishing bridges between the church and the secular world, actually. She patrols the streets of your parish. And what does she say in verses 4 and 5? She calls, she lifts up her voice, and she appeals to all mankind to have sense. Verse 6, "You will have plain speech from me." What does it mean? What does this actually mean for us? The Creator has empowered his creation for witness. That's what it means. And you and I should love her and receive her and be respectful. She is a co-witness along with us, but we couldn't witness unless she was at it. She serves his work of salvation. She impinges on the mind of people. She nudges and she touches and she whispers, "Look around you. Is this what you want? Is this what life is all about? Is this satisfying you?" I remember as a 12-year-old standing on the street corner outside our block of our blitz, shattered block of flats in Fulham, in darkest London, as a 12-year-old looking at it, thinking, gosh, there must be more to it. What was I looking at? I was looking at violated wisdom. The houses were bombed, the place was wretched, the pubs were full, and you get this feeling, something is telling me something here. There must be more to it than this. This is how wisdom impinges on people. And if you are not too sure about this, if you think that this is conferring too much authority upon creation, then I commend to you Job 38:42, which we will not read now, but I would just ask you just to turn to it and to note it. It is the most extraordinary section. Job 38:42 shows you that when God confers wisdom upon creation, as we have been saying, how real this is, what authority the created order has, what voice she has to address the world. So, and you know how it goes there in Job, that since chapter 2, God has not said a word as the great man has whinged and whined on chapter after chapter, complaining that God has treated him badly. And then when at last he does speak, he doesn't speak. When at last God addresses his complaining child, he actually turns to creation and says, "You tell him for me." For God to say that obviously assumes that he believes it can. That when creation speaks of herself and shows herself as she is, she will speak of God, of the Creator. And so what you get is this machine gun burst of questions. Were you there? Have you seen? Do you know? Do you understand? Have you seen where the snow is made? Have you seen the stars and so on? One after the other, the funny stuff and the serious stuff, the light-hearted parts of creation, the little monkeys and the terrifying alligators and the whole thing. And the whole thing speaks of power and wisdom and things that I can't control and yet threatens my life, because God is also like that. Until the famous penny drops famously, and there in verse 6 of chapter 42, "And now I see," says. What did he see? Well, he saw creation. God has said to him, "Shut up for a moment, come outside, now look as I run the universe past you. And I know that if you will look at this intelligently, you will understand what's going on here, that there is a power, there is an intelligence, there is a love, there is a grace, there is a mysterious order to things, there is a purpose to things, and I feed and I care for creation. This, presumably, this penny dropped. And it's happening, and you and I should cash in on this. We should assume this. Here's a couple of instances. Here's one from a young woman working in the entertainment industry in a seaside town. Dispirited by the tawdriness around her, she took a break and went for a stroll. This is what she says. It was a glorious sunny evening, and I walked through the park and sat down by the water intending to read. I never opened my book. It was very beautiful with the sun glinting through the trees and the ducks swimming on the water, and quite suddenly I felt lifted beyond all the turmoil and conflict. There was no visual image, and I knew I was sitting on a seat in the park, but I felt as if I was lifted above the world and looking down on it. The disillusion and cynicism were gone, and I felt compassion suffusing my whole being, compassion for all the people of earth. I was possessed by a peace that I had never felt before or since, and what is to me most interesting and curious of all, the whole state was not emotional. It was as if I took a break and went for a stroll. This is what she says. It was a glorious sunny evening, and I walked through the park and sat down by the water intending to read. I never opened my book. It was very beautiful with the sun glinting through the trees and the ducks swimming on the water, and quite suddenly I felt lifted beyond all the turmoil and conflict. There was no visual image, and I knew I was sitting on a seat in the park, but I felt as if I was lifted above the world and looking down on it. The disillusion and cynicism were gone, and I felt compassion suffusing my whole being, compassion for all the people of earth. I was possessed by a peace that I have never felt before or since, and what is to me most interesting and curious of all, the whole state was not emotional. It was as if I was not without emotion, but beyond it. The experience passed off gradually and I suppose lasted 20, 30 minutes. At the time, I thought it was an experience of God because I saw it according to my spiritual framework. Here's another one, a Scottish one. Young man climbing in Scotland. I was climbing first and was ahead of my companions. The roar of a waterfall nearby was deafening until I climbed over the rim of the rock face. In absolute quiet, with a beautiful scenic panorama, I found God. I was no longer aware of myself, and yet I retained my personality. This was, however, touching infinity, it seemed to me. The personality of the world was there. Peace, love, and understanding became real and tangible. And so you find this all over the place. People are having these experiences all over the place. Who is ministering? Wisdom is ministering to those who will listen to her and makes our ministry possible and viable. So to the second personification in Proverbs. The first one was Mother Superior, or your big sister. The second one famously, of course, in Proverbs 8. Proverbs 8 from verses 22 to 31, you know this classic passage. Verse 22 of Proverbs 8, the Lord created me, the first of his works, long ago. Before all else that he made, I was formed in earliest times, at the beginning, before earth itself. I was born when there was yet no ocean, when there were no springs brimming with water, before the mountains were settled in their place, before the hills I was born. When as yet he had made neither land nor streams nor the mass of the earth's soil. When he set the heavens in place, I was there. When he girdled the ocean with the horizon, when he fixed the canopy of clouds overhead and confined the springs of the deep, when he prescribed limits for the sea so that the waters do not transgress his command, when he made earth's foundations firm, then I was at his side each day. And then famously, you've got a choice with the next metaphor, either the craftsman or his darling and his delight, the beloved child, the favorite child, playing in his presence. That sounds like the child, doesn't it? Playing in his presence continually, playing over his whole world, while my delight was in mankind. This is the creating wisdom, and this, of course, is behind Colossians 1 and 2, chapter 2, verse 6. Those great Christological passages. But just take, if we dare, take on board the implications of this image. That the wisdom by which God creates and imbues the world and imprints on into the textures and the fibers of life, his way of preserving and blessing the world and making it possible to go forward, is this darling child, this delightful child, this favorite infant, playing in God's presence continually, playing over his whole world, while my delight was in mankind. Well then, from this, I take it, we understand that everything which delights, which streams to us out of creation with delight and satisfaction and joy and elation, is the gift and the expression of wisdom. Obviously poetry, hence they write in a poetic way, and music and relationships and laughter, and whatever you will, whatever brings delight to creation. The point is that, and this is the life of the imagination, the point is that these are our stepping stones. These are not aliens trying to nudge some place into our church program, this naughty stuff called poetry and music and drama, this kind of thing. This is wisdom. That laughing, delightful child played in the playground of creation with the sons of men and has taught us how to play. Christian people should know how to play more than anyone. Of course, you make decisions. You can't spend all your life playing. I'm not saying that. And what we say is, in actual fact, I've got work to do, but my word, I do understand play. I understand that we are made for delight. We are made for the seventh day. We are made for Sabbath rest. And we delight in creation and in these wondrous gifts of music and of poetry and whatever delights you. Now, I stand before you as a mere ignorant Englishman, so you'll understand if I quote this from the introduction to this lovely recent anthology of Scottish religious poetry. This is not an Englishman speaking, these are three Scots editors speaking. And they talk about the impact of the Reformation. Well, Eric Alexander, I'm glad you're not here. The impact of the Reformation on the Church of Scotland, from this point of view. I quote, "Radical change followed quickly. From an artistic point of view, the iconoclasm of a reformist vision, which stripped out almost all mediation of religious experience through music, sculpture, and verse, changed the course of the cultural life of Scotland. There had occurred a sudden foreshortening of the metaphorical and aesthetic end of the spiritual continuum in which writers and artists, of course, work most confidently." So it's not just an elitist thing, a swanky upper-class thing, to enjoy that kind of stuff. It is wisdom. It is wisdom playing among us, giving us a delight in making and carving and painting and rhyming and singing. I know this is ancient history. It's very interesting to note this. And our Catholic friends, our most perceptive and generous Catholic friends, like Wolf Balthasar, very profound spiritual men, do just rather teasingly point out that we burned our bridges. Protestants have burned our bridges between ourselves and society because we won't allow these stepping stones of this kind of thing, of what the playful child has given us by way of aesthetic and artistic experience. I don't know what you think of that. But anyway, these are the work of wisdom. Justin said, the early church father, "Everything good and everything beautiful belongs to us." What a turnaround. Then if there was a time when the church said everything good and everything beautiful, it's a bit of a threat actually. It kind of takes your eye off the gospel and the mission. No, it belongs to us. She is wisdom, she is the child. And they are our stepping stones to people. And so they're not rushing into our churches, they are terribly interested in poetry and art and all kinds of expressions. And we should be on their side and say, we know where this is coming from. This is witnessed wisdom bearing witness to the kind of God that we have. The God of the perichoresis, the God of the Trinity in their eternal dance, ever giving themselves to each other, and moving to each other, and coming away from each other, and spilling over into creation. What kind of creation is it if the laughing, playing child has made it? Ecstatic joy. Except you and I have been blackmailed by misery, you see. There is misery, don't we know it? And not only do we try by the grace of God to respond to misery, we allow it to shut us up. Oh gosh, you know, it's so miserable. There's no way I can indulge these things. Oh yes, you can. It's one thing to identify with those who are suffering and in need. It's another thing to violate wisdom. Because what kind of God are we bearing witness to? The beautiful God must be witnessed to beautifully, with all the beauty at our disposal. You know, David Ford, Professor David Ford's writings, I love him. He's both profoundly theological and very spiritual. And he says this about us: praise is about pleasure. Christianity has been understandably reticent about the joy, bliss, delight, and sheer pleasure at its heart. But it is so, simply because its God is the God of joy. Christian hedonism is the holy intoxication of pleasing and being pleased by God. And that sums up the experience of true praise. So apparently the laughing, playful child of wisdom is saying to us, say to the world, we understand why you seek hedonism. We are made for ecstasy. We understand. But I tell you what, that's very unwise the way you're going. And end up in trouble. And by the way, our hedonism is better than your hedonism. So rather than in any way wagging the finger of being negative. The last remark, it occurred to me, if we look for applications of this in the life of the church in the New Testament, surely the most fascinating instance of this is in Acts 17. When Paul has to take for a second time his text. You remember in Acts 17 when he goes into the synagogue and he teaches in the synagogue, and we know what he's saying, we can understand his language, he would be quoting the prophets and Christ as their fulfillment. And then he comes outside the door, and my guess is he carries on speaking in a similar way, quoting Isaiah 53 and so on. And he is classically is misheard, he is misunderstood, and he is misrepresented. Ah, this babbler is saying. And so famously they take him, see, you come to where we meet. He goes onto their ground. But not before he had looked for wisdom at work in their culture. And he found it, didn't he? Of all the things he could have referred to, he saw this carving, this piece of sculpture, this pagan inscription to an unknown god, the cry for help. Wisdom had been at work in that culture and had provoked people to acknowledge, we don't know what we're doing here, and so we will worship the unknown god. That is the work of wisdom, the pre-evangelism, the stepping stone. And that wise man spotted it straight away, and of all the things he could have referred to in Athens, he refers to this, and then takes them by the hand and leads them on a tour through their own culture. As some of your own poets have said, we are the children of God. Now that is a wondrous man. That's a wonderful vision. He is a man who presupposes wisdom at work in culture. Some cultures are so corrupt you can hardly see it, I know. But by the grace of God, there are things going on in our society, things there which reflect wisdom, and you and I need to discern them and to home in on them and use them as stepping stones to the gospel.
Literature. So, open to anybody.